Come to our 10 o'clock message, sort of 10 o'clock message slash Sunday school type of thing, right? We're in 2 Samuel chapter 14. The old saying is that to do nothing is a vote for the status quo, right? And David is very adept at doing nothing when it comes to his family. And so we see the consequences rolling on. Matter of fact, ever since the judgment pronounced in 2 Samuel chapter 12, we have David going from one indecision to another, each one having more and more devastating impact. And so here, 2 Samuel chapter 14, starting verse 25, it says, "And now in all Israel there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his feet to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut his hair of his head at the end of every year, he cut it because it was heavy on him. When he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels according to the king's standard. To Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of beautiful appearance. And Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face. Therefore Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again the second time, he would not come. And so he said to his servant, 'See, Joab's field is near mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire.' And Absalom's servants set it on the field on fire. And Joab arose and came to Absalom's house and said to him, 'Why have your servants set my field on fire?' And Absalom answered Joab, said, 'Look, I sent to you saying, come here so that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better if I'd still be there. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face, but if there is iniquity in me, let him execute me.' So Joab went to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed down on his face to the ground before the king. Then the king kissed Absalom." Strange. Very, very strange. Joab, remember, had convinced David to bring Absalom back from Geshur, where he had fled after killing Amnon. And Amnon, who had raped Tamar, but David had done nothing about the crime. Matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. You know, Absalom was very close to his sister. He named his only daughter after her. And this is one of the few places I find in the entire scriptures where the sons are not named, but the daughter is. It's usually just the opposite. And so he names his only daughter after the sister who was raped by Amnon. And David had done nothing about the crime. I mean, Absalom waited, right? Tamar waited, and Absalom waited. After 2 years, it was obvious David wasn't going to do anything. And Amnon, of course, would be lifted up in confidence because he got away with the whole thing. And so after 2 years, Absalom says that he has to take matters into his own hands, and he murdered Amnon. So So Absalom fled to Geshur, east of the Sea of Galilee, and we mentioned last week that that's the same area that's in the New Testament called Decapolis, the same area of the Gadarenes, is where Jesus had cast out legion, right? And it's the same area. A lot of Gentiles lived in that area. And so he flees to the king there. And after a while, again, nothing happens. Absalom isn't called back. There's been no contact. And so finally, Joab knew that David was moaning and groaning, oh, my son Absalom, after he got over the murder of Amnon, and yet he does nothing. So Joab has a ruse. He takes a woman from Tekoa. She pretends like her son has fled because he had accidentally killed his brother in a fight, and, you know, what should I do? And David says, you know, nothing's going to happen to your son. I'm going to make sure of that. And then she turns around and says, well, you're the man. Why don't you bring your own son back who you banished? And so David says, well, is Joab with you in this? And she says, surely Joab has put these words in my mouth. And so he finds it. So both Joab and Absalom believe, as the king calls Absalom back, that he'd come before the king and then he would face the consequences. But David again proves unwilling to do anything. He says, listen, he may come back into the land, but he can never see my face. Well, the whole point of bringing him back is to what? Yeah, sure, to bring him back and to deal with this issue, right? And he's still his father's son, right? And so they bring him back, and the face of consequences, but nothing happens. Now, David has proven unwilling to hold his children to account, just like Eli and Samuel. We see this in those men. Eli, you know, has his sons helped him in the priesthood. They are seducing the women in the tabernacle. They're stealing the money. They're stealing the best of the offering for themselves. And so God tells Samuel, go to Eli and tell him, you know, judgment's on his house if he doesn't take care of his sons. And all Eli does, he goes to his son and says, you shouldn't be doing those things. I mean, that's kind of a very tepid, weak response. And then so when Samuel was sent back to Eli, he tells Eli, listen, because you've honored my sons over top of me, I had determined to have your house be in the priesthood for all generations, but after the fourth generation, I'm taking it away. And Eli's tepid response is, well, the Lord do whatever he wants to do. I mean, it's just a weak, mamby-pamby situation. Matter of fact, let me make this comment. I mean, this is all the way through history. Whether it's a monarchy or whether it's by election, usually the best people don't get to the top. You notice that? I mean, it's not the wisest, you know, it's not the most generous, right? It's not the ones with the greatest amount of discernment. It's the manipulators and the grabbers. And in a monarchy, you know, matter of fact, Solomon mentions that over in Ecclesiastes. He says, you know, I'm going to be giving all my wealth away to whoever comes after me. Who knows if he's going to be wise or a fool? Well, of course, Solomon wasn't on the top of the list when it comes to being discerning himself, even though God gave him that right, but he didn't use it very wisely. And so that's in an monarchy, you pass on to the next generation. Who knows if he's going to be a good king or not? Matter of fact, it became worse in Europe because they all interbred, right? Everybody was a cousin to somebody else in Germany and England and Russia. And matter of fact, when Kaiser Wilhelm went to war with, Tsar Nicholas, they were cousins. Talk about a feud, right? You know, where millions of people die in this cousins fighting each other. And King George, you know, he was a Hessian. You know, he wasn't, the first two Georges really never showed up in England, never spoke English. And George III was a madman, you know. And so, wow, you know. So, but in our country, it's usually the corrupt and the manipulators that rise to the top. It's not your wisest, it's not your best. Matter of fact, I remember one of my history courses in college was Russian history. And they had a guy, Alexander II, who was pretty wise, trying to do some improvements for Russia, and he was assassinated. I mean, it was an old 60s song about the good dying young, right? You know, where are you, Father Abraham? The good always die young. And so so we come here, and David does the same thing. Samuel, same thing. Samuel is a tremendous judge, but apparently a lousy father. One thing I would have liked to have known, maybe you would too, is, you know, Samuel's wife is never mentioned. You got to wonder, you know. But we know that home works best if you have a strong father figure, right? It really does. Because mom can't really play both roles very well. And so Samuel had the same problem. So here's a great judge, but he's a lousy father. And one of the things that you see in Samuel is the fact that, you know, if you know what your children are like, why would you put them in a position of authority, right? Why would you make them judges? And that's one of the things that motivates the people to say, we want a king, you know, enough of this. But he says the kings are going to be worse, you know. Well, the people need to do what? They need to go to God and say, hey, you know, these sons of Samuel aren't doing well. What do they do? And he would have provided a proper judge, right? So that, because judgeships were not inherited. If you notice all the judges, you know, whether it's Deborah or Shamgar or Gideon, were all chosen by God. He's the one that chose them. And so we pick up the story here that his son. Now I want you to notice this thought really struck me as I was preparing this message. Do you realize that his sons did the exact same type of crime that David did? David committed adultery with another man's wife. Amnon rapes his half sister. Sexual crime. David made sure that another man killed Uriah, whereas Absalom had his servants kill Amnon, see? Now, I think here's the crux of the matter. You know, David is wondering, how can he punish his sons for doing the same thing that he did? And I think here's a very important point to consider, is the fact that David never truly reconciled completely what he did. You know, he confessed before God, but he never came before the people, right? He never came before his family. He never reconciled with his servants. You know, he kept, you know, he just ignored it as if, you know, well, I'll just pretend like it didn't happen. Listen, unless you reconcile the past, you really can't properly go into the future. You really can't. You know, and so you can't with authority say, son, don't do this when you've done it yourself without first saying, son, I did the same thing that you just did, and here's the consequences I've had to pay, right? If you read, I think his first name is Bob McDonald, George McDonald, the pastor was, you know, caught with adultery with his secretary. He went through the whole reconciliation process, right? Got back in the pulpit, and now with authority, he can say, this is wrong, this is what I paid, and move forward. Because if you have that something that someone has against you, it's awful hard for you to, with authority, be able to implement proper justice. So David doesn't properly reconcile these issues amongst the people and in the kingdom, he sort of pretends like it doesn't happen. If something's happened, you can't pretend like it didn't. And it'll always crop up to bite you, won't it? By the way, ever notice if you have a skeleton in a closet that people are always picking the lock? They know something's back there. They know they have something on you. And so not confronting the issue doesn't make the issue go away. Matter of fact, the issue festers. And, you know, we have a saying about, one rotten apple does what? Spoils the whole bush. So if you don't take care of the rotten apple, you're going to have problems throughout. Now, Absalom had not seen his father for 3 years. Absalom was the banished prince. And by the way, let me mention this, something that's usually not mentioned is the fact he was banished de facto. In other words, he was never brought before the king and said, I'm banishing you. He just was banished. When he went to Geshur, he just, stay there. And David moves on as if nothing had happened, and yet he's moaning all the time, oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son. And so this is kind of a strange affair. Isn't it interesting? This is a guy that can face down a giant but can't face down the problems in his own family. See that? Does it remind you of someone else in the New Testament? Peter's waving a sword. He's going to defend Jesus Christ, but a little slave girl comes up to him and says, you were with Jesus. And what did Peter say? I don't know him. And so he could stand before this troops coming to arrest Jesus, but he could not stand before the servant girl. And when he accuses him of just being one of the group that's with Jesus. So now we have trouble brewing. Now, isn't it interesting? The first thing they mentioned here is Absalom is one handsome dude. That's an NIV translation. Right? One handsome dude. He's really, you have all the king man. There's no one like, this is the Brad Pitt of the day, or whatever, And he's kind of old though now, right? Isn't he? I don't know who the new hunks are, but he's a guy, without blemish. It says they remove 5 pounds of hair off his head every year. That's like having a sack of flour on your head every year. By the way, this is a side note. I know I might get shot for this, but I never understood, I'd hear when we were in high school and stuff, and a guy with long hair, and the girls were just, oh, he's got such nice hair. And I just thought, really? It's a girl thing, I'm thinking, yuck. And they say, boy, I wish I had hair like that. I'm just, this is a world that I'm not, I don't understand this world. But he was that type of guy. They said, have you seen Absalom's hair? Only his hairdresser knows. Now, that's an old reference. But here, they took 5 pounds of hair off the guy's head every year. And I guess that'd be a lot to carry around, And all Israel's drawn to him. And you had 3 issues here that David's not even aware of. Number one, just as appearance would draw sympathy. You ever notice that they give, the Hollywood divas, the benefit of the doubt just because they're celebrities and attractive and stuff. You have marches and free Britney Spears. She's a wackanoodle. talent, attractive, but she's still a wackanoodle. That's the way with Absalom, right? And we'll see that in the next chapter. There's a guy you want to follow. By the way, isn't that where we got in problem before? Saul looked like someone that was what? Yeah, he looks like, man, head and shoulders above everything, strong guy. Boy, we'd follow this guy, And he was big in stature and small in character. And you'd rather have a man who's big in character, small in stature. And one of the greatest men who's ever lived was William Wilberforce. Guy didn't tip 5 foot tall. But it, you know, as one of his critics says, as he spoke, the shrimp became a whale. And so here we have this guy. He was handsome, and more handsome than anyone else. You know, he was he would be the guy on the Bachelor who the girls would want to be, pick him, and that type of guy. You know, so he was attractive. Secondly, many would feel they was justified in what he did with Amnon, right? You know, they would. I mean, as I mentioned last week, the guy that I saw in a documentary had killed this other guy because he'd raped his mother, you know, and cops weren't doing anything, so he took it in his own hand and in jail. And I couldn't completely blame the guy, right? I mean, in a sense, I mean, you can imagine the rage. I understand the law and all this stuff, but man, I can't imagine the rage. And this is again another sign. I can't imagine the rage that the family of the woman who was killed, waiting for her son to be inducted in the Navy Academy, when the guy who killed her was on home detention, had been accused of 2 murders. And he cuts off the ankle brace and goes down and kills someone else. I mean, I can't imagine what the rage would be. And then the idiot, I mean, the honorable mayor of Annapolis stands up and says, oh, it's about guns, guns, and more guns. No, I'm sorry. It's about you did not execute justice for this family. I don't want this to be a political speech, but... But you see, some would say he was justified in doing it, since David wasn't going to take matters, you know, when he should have in his hands, absent to his head. Thirdly, they probably felt that his banishment, continued banishment from the palace, was unjust. So Absalom probably had a lot of supporters behind him. You know, if you'd just check the social media post, you know. So he probably had a lot of people who would say, you know, I'm for this guy. Now here's something else that we need to note here, and we see this all the way through, all the way to the end of the book. David seems totally unaware of what's happening now beyond the palace gates, right? He seems unaware of what's going on. When in the next chapter where we see Absalom gaining support to take over the kingdom, he seems to be totally oblivious to it. He's totally oblivious to what's happening in his own family. He's totally unaware. You know, one of the things that you have to be if you're going to lead is be aware of what's going on, right? You know, one of the things that always frustrated me is over the years is when something's happened in a congregation, I've become the last to find out. And people are talking to me as if I knew, don't you know what's going on? No, I have no idea, you know. One of the things is you've got to have an ear to the ground, right? You know, sure, like everybody's talking about, well, I don't know. And you know, so this is the whole idea. David totally lacked discernment what's going on. He's totally in his own little world. So Absalom decides to make his move. Absalom gets tired of waiting to be called to the palace. He calls Joab twice. Joab doesn't want anything more to do with it, right? I mean, he went out of the way, came to David did the whole ruse thing and then David brings Absalom back and he's in the kingdom. And Joab said, that's all I can do. I can't force David, you know, to bring Joab into the palace. That's up to Absalom now. So Absalom calls him once, he doesn't come, calls him twice, he doesn't come. So Absalom, who seems to use his servants as his hitmen, right? Says, yes. He says, listen, Joab's field's right over there. I want you to go out in the barley field. I want you to set it on fire. Now, that got Joab's attention, by the way. And so they went over there and they set his barley field on fire. And Joab got his attention. Joab comes over and says, what are you doing having your servants set my field on fire? He said, Absalom said, listen, I called you twice. And he made 3 obvious points here. Number one, he said, listen, it would have been better for me to stay in Geshur than to come close to the palace and not be able to go into the palace, right? I mean, at least if I'm in a foreign country, I know that I'm not going to be able to go in the palace. But now I'm within the shadow of the palace, I still can't go into the palace, right? By the way, I can't use this passage without thinking when Gene and I went to Israel, Absalom's tomb was right there in front of the Eastern Gate wall. At least they said it was Absalom's tomb. You know, and so there was a large tomb built there. And so, first of all, I better stay. Secondly, I thought if I was going to be brought back home, I'd be brought back home, right? I mean, really home, right? Not just in the land, but I'd actually be brought back into the palace and talk to the king, whatever the consequences are. Then the third point, which I think is very valid, he says, listen, let me see the king, whether he pronounces judgment and executes or not, that's better than not being a non-person. He said, let's face this down face to face. You know, we can go through the whole thing about the rape and about Dave not doing anything. And yes, I did commit murder. And if you want to execute me for that, but do something, right? Do something. And so here Joab goes and tells the king, really, you need to see your son. You brought him back. You haven't seen him. Now this to me says everything about David in these matters. David doesn't say anything. Brings him forward. Absalom falls on his face before the king. In other words, I'm ready to accept your judgment, right? All the king does is lift him up and he kisses him. That's it. I kept looking, and he said what? He didn't say anything. I mean, if you're going to reconcile, you need a what? You need to reconcile. You need to deal with the issues, right? Now, you know when you have a discussion with your spouse, right? You want to come to some kind of conclusion. You want to get the facts out. You want to get how I feel about this. Nothing. There's no dealing with the murder. There's no dealing with the rape. There's no dealing with David's, what he did. There's none of that. Now listen, restoration without accountability is complicity. Restoration without accountability is complicity. In other words, what you're saying is it's all right what you did. By not saying anything, by not pronouncing judgment or dealing with the issue, you're saying we're just going to pretend like it never happened. The problem is it did happen, right? Now, Absalom and others around David lose total respect and authority. How do I know that? Because what happens in the next chapter? Absalom easily takes a large part of Israel, brings them over to himself. Listen, if you're going to rule, you're going to have to do what? You're going to have to rule. And where do they want to see the highest form of governance? Well, in your own household, right? Even in God's household, it says judgment begins where? Household of God, right? What is one of the standards of being an elder or a deacon in 1 Timothy 3, right? The man has to be able to do what? Govern his own household, right? If he can't govern his household well, how's he going to govern the church? So it all starts with the family, and so they lose total respect for David. The meeting is so anticlimactic that it's unbelievable. I imagine Absalom walked away saying, what? Say something, right? Let's talk this thing through. David just comes over, lifts him up, and kisses him on the cheek, and that's it. So David does not express anger. He doesn't expect disappointment. He doesn't express disapproval. He doesn't express anything. This is very similar to Eli's response, right? Well, sons, at least he says, sons, you shouldn't be doing that. And so, just like Amnon, Absalom walks away with carte blanche, right? Whatever Absalom does, David's going to do what? Nothing. So Absalom's going to bring this to the head, which fulfills the prophecy back in chapter 12 that your very neighbor is going to be lying with your wives. That's going to come up in the next chapter. Let's have a word of prayer. Let's have a discussion on this because there's a lot of valuable principles in this narrative here. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you, Lord, for this day. Thank you, Lord, for the teachings here that we have in the passage. And Lord, just may we learn from it and be with our discussion now through Jesus Christ. Amen.